soul transmigrates, explaining the process of birth and death and what it really means in terms of identification with one body, giving up that body, and then assuming identification with the new body. It's also just been explained in the last couple of verses that there's a forgetfulness of one's old life, that that's past. Consciousness no longer, at least for the most part, does not remember the past lifetime and identifies with the new body. Now in the verse today, verse 42, it's further explaining how this attachment arises. Due to the identification with the new body, one becomes very attached, particularly the mind, which is described as the sitting place or the resting place of the senses, creates an identification with the new body, and then the threefold varieties of miseries begin, and the conception of duality develops. So the living entity sees differences. The word bida is mentioned here, but often in the Bhagavad Gita, this word dvandva is used for duality. Right? See that in several places in Bhagavad Gita. And therefore, not only is there this duality is created in terms of making distinction or differentiation, but there's a value judgment. And one sees in terms of this is higher, this is better, this is not so good, you know, high, middle, and low class. But it's described that the differences are illusory. And they do not pertain to the soul, but only to the body. And therefore, that is why devotees, Vaishnavas, are ultimately not very interested in material distinction. Someone may have more intelligence or less intelligence or more wealth or less wealth, but these things are really of not so much concern to us because ultimately they don't pertain to the nature of the soul and they don't pertain to the nature of devotional service or bhakti. So one can be filled with bhakti or very little bhakti regardless of one's material circumstances or material qualities. And we can see that, of course, in our own movement here, we come from so many different backgrounds. None of these preclude us becoming devotees of the Lord. Now, an interesting example is given here about the father and the son. It's described that a father may be a good person, may have, you know, all good qualities, but the son might have many bad qualities or have difficulties. Maybe there are criminal activities or moral activities, transgressions. And what happens sometimes is the father wants to support the son or defend the son or help the son, and then he becomes implicated in those activities. Sometimes we call this in modern psychology enabling. You know, in other words, a parent may so much care about the child that they'll try to protect them, support them, and sometimes even when there's no real sense of reality or when it's really inappropriate. So in this way, sometimes the parent can become very implicated in the activities of the children in an inappropriate way. It really is not helpful, but it's simply implicating all of those. So in the same way, it's described here how the soul itself has no difficulty, has no implication with the three modes of nature. But in association with the modes of nature, the consciousness becomes covered, and we take on the material qualities. This perception of duality comes about. It is not the nature of the soul itself, but becomes implicated or covered due to the mind and the senses and our identification with those. It's also described in this verse that this duality is both internal and external. Now, the purport didn't really describe this concept particularly. I don't think it's really mentioned further. But in Vishwanatha Chakravarti Thakura's purport, he does mention the internal and external nature of duality. And he describes that external differences are qualities perceived by the senses, like the ear, and the internal differences are perceived by the mind and the intelligence. So the consciousness of duality can be both on the gross or the subtle level. He also mentions another interesting point, of which I don't have a lot more information or particularly that much realization about, but he mentions that the three differences perceived can also be states of waking, which is connected with the senses, dreaming, the mind, or deep sleep, the intelligence. Again, I don't have more information on that. I know Srila Prabhupada once mentioned that we actually need to sleep because of the intelligence. Intelligence needs to rest and be renewed by deep sleep. So I didn't have time to study it more, but there's obviously some connection between the state of deep sleep and intelligence and dreamy state with the mind, and of course, waking state, the senses, that one's fairly clear. We can understand that. So this concept, I guess we could say the problem of duality. It's there from the very beginning of Bhagavad Gita. When Krishna first began speaking to Arjuna, Arjuna is experiencing duality. He's experiencing distress. And so immediately Krishna, practically the second or third verse, 14, that he began speaking, he says, that the non-permanent appearance of happiness and distress and their disappearance in due course of time, like the appearance and disappearance of winter and summer seasons, they rise from sense perception. One must learn to tolerate without being disturbed. So immediately Krishna says the problem here is duality. The problem here is seeing happiness and distress, identification with the body, the senses, and everything that is goes along with that. So, in fact, it's of such importance that in the very next verse, Krishna gives a sort of a beginning hint to the process of liberation. He says, the person who is not disturbed by happiness and distress, instead in both, is certainly eligible for liberation. So, throughout our scriptures, we are enjoined to transcend duality, something that comes up frequently, particularly in the Bhagavad Gita. Another way of saying this is that we need to give up material attachment. We need to give up these identifications with the mind, the body, and the senses, you know, that create the duality, of course, is created in the mind, and therefore we get off track. As I was looking at this idea of duality and looking at some of these verses in Srila Prabhupada's purports, it seemed like that there are different aspects of duality. I saw that there's sort of like three different aspects of duality or different forms of illusion that the spirit soul can undergo. The first is seeing this sort of binary sensory differences, such as happiness and distress, that, you know, that the senses certainly make these distinctions. This is good, this is bad, rich, poor, whatever it might be, happiness, distress. That's what we often think of as duality. But there's also seen differences in the distinction or misidentification between the soul and the body. Now, of course, there is a real distinction, but the misidentification is part of duality. And then also seeing duality is sometimes talked about in terms of seeing the ultimate differences between the self, material energies, and Krishna. Now, Krishna has variegated energies, and we know that there are distinctions and differences between his energies. At the same time, duality would be described as seeing things different from Krishna, seeing that there's something apart from Krishna, or Krishna's not involved. Krishna's obviously involved in everything. Give some examples of those. Bhagavad Gita talks about this idea of duality a lot. 254, the Vedas deal mainly with the subject of the three modes of material nature. Arjuna, become transcendental to these modes, be free from all dualities, from all anxiety of gain and safety. So this is that sort of binary sense of gain and safety. 422, he who is satisfied with gain which comes of its own accord, who is free from duality and does not envy, steady in success and failure, never entangled. And 727, for all living entities are born into delusion, bewildered by the dualities arisen by desire and hate. And Prabhupada says, the duality of the material world is felt in terms of heat and cold, misery and happiness, desire and hate. So we also see that those doubts, that sometimes we see misidentification with the material body. From Srila Prabhupada's purport, 1.15.31, he says, doubts of duality begin from the misconception of the material body, which is accepted as the self by less intelligent persons. The most foolish part of our ignorance is identifying this material body with the self. And then finally, duality is described as generally not understanding Krishna behind everything. This is from the purport of Bhagavad Gita 5.12. In the Bhagavatam, the cause of anxiety over the result of an activity is explained as being one functioning in the conception of duality. That is, without knowledge of the absolute truth. Krishna is the supreme truth, the personality of Godhead. In Krishna consciousness, there is no duality. All that exists is a product of Krishna's energy, and Krishna is all good. Therefore, activities in Krishna consciousness are on the absolute plane and have no material effect. So, we can understand from many of these statements the importance of understanding this idea of duality. And as being described here, the mind, the resting place of the senses, has created this identification and created this duality. So our greatest problem in spiritual advancement is often the mind, which creates these material conceptions of life. And the Bhagavad Gita tells us that the mind can be our best friend or our worst enemy. In Bhagavad Gita 6, 5, and 6, one who must deliver himself with the help of his mind and not degrade himself, the mind is the friend of the conditioned soul and its enemy as well. So the problem is that the mind is the focal point of the senses and it accepts and rejects. It's taking in sensory information. It's sort of the clearinghouse of everything that we're perceiving in this material world. And it makes value judgments. I like this. I don't like this. This is pleasurable. This is not pleasurable. Distress, suffering, whatever. And so it's experiencing the sensory information. That's all happening within the mind. Now, the mind alone, without the help of intelligence, cannot understand higher truth. It's described that even the intelligence is required even to understand the difference between spirit and matter. Prabhupada has described this. This is the function of intelligence. They can make these distinctions and finer discrimination. Of course, the materially contaminated intelligence, its discrimination tends to be more about, okay, my mind wants this, how do I get it? In other words, how do I make a good plan? How do I, achieve my objectives in this material world? And so the intelligence may study, may do whatever it's needed to achieve a certain objective. It does not necessarily bring one to spiritual life. But the properly situated intelligence, the spiritual intelligence, can make the distinction matter and spirit and help to bring us to higher truth. Because the mind is a subtle material element that is covered and cannot actually perceive spiritual reality. So the mind is usually thinking that, our consciousness is accustomed to think the mind as the self. There's often this misidentification. There's an interesting purport. Srila Prabhupada writes 429.7 Bhagavatam. According to training, the mind is the friend and the enemy of the living entity. If one gets a good manager, his estate is very nicely managed. But if the manager is a thief, his estate is spoiled. Similarly, in this material, conditional existence, the living entity gives power of attorney to his mind. As such, he is liable to be misdirected by his mind into enjoying sense objects. So this is an interesting example or analogy that Srila Prabhupada gives. He says, we've given power attorney to the mind. In other words, we let the mind dictate everything for us. Whatever the mind wants, that's the direction I'll go. My consciousness becomes covered by the mind, and that becomes our future direction. Instead, we should be giving power of mind to the intelligence informed by, of course, spiritual authority. Anyway, the mind has these mental attachments, which obviously lead to a particular set of activity, of action, karma, and behaviors, then we will obtain different bodies. So this process of samsara and transmigration is just beginning to be explained and will be continued to be developed throughout this chapter. Prabhupada says 7.13.27 explains this. Says, if one does not act for the satisfaction of Krishna, he must be entangled in the reactions of fruitive activity. By pious activity, one is elevated to the higher planetary systems, and by impious activity, one is degraded to the lower species of life, and which is punished by the laws of nature. Now, this question came up the other day when we were talking about this, about what happens, the difference between animal consciousness and human consciousness. Prabhupada said, in the lower species of life, there's an evolutionary process. And when the term of the living entity's imprisonment or punishment in the lower species is finished, he is again offered a human form and given a chance to decide for himself which way he should plan. So actual choice, free will, as we describe it, really comes about in the human form of life, not so much in the animal and plant life. If he again misses the opportunity, he's put again into the cycle of birth and death, sometimes higher, sometimes lower. Now, all of this is understandable, but may seem like a very difficult process for a living entity. And sometimes people ask, well, why does God allow this? Why does God allow all this suffering, the cycle of birth and death, all of the difficulty that goes on in this material world? Because after all, this place called Mrityaloka, a place of death, we see there's so much suffering here, threefold miseries, birth, death, disease, and old age. Not a very nice place. So Krishna is not responsible for our karma, not responsible for the bodies and the subsequent suffering of living entity. We receive a particular body due to the laws of nature and our own actions and the karma that comes about from those actions. And therefore, we create our bodies through our activity, and that develops our consciousness. Prabhupada 2.6.42, this material manifestation is necessary to give a chance to the conditioned souls who are unwilling to associate with the Lord in the relationship of loving transcendental service. It's actually described that there would be no material world without the desires of living entity. If we do not have the desire to enjoy or try to control, try to act as God in some way, there would be no need for this material world. But, you know, so we are, in one sense, our consciousness is the creator of this material situation. In fact, the whole material universe. Therefore, we are also the creator of our own situation. And due to our activities and due to that consciousness, we create the particular body that we are inhabiting and its subsequent happiness and distress. So there's obviously a need for us to develop spiritual practice and consciousness to avoid the situation. Srila Prabhupada says in the purport to that verse, one's thoughts during the course of one's life accumulate to influence one's thoughts at the moment of death, so this life creates one's next life. If in one's present life one lives in the mode of goodness and always thinks of Krishna, it is possible for one to remember Krishna at the end of life. And then, of course, famous verse, Bhagavad Gita describes this, yang bhavi smran bhavam dvajajante kalevram damtam ivaiti kontaya sadatad bhava bhavitam, 8.6. Whatever state of being one remembers when he quits his body, O son of Kunti, that state he will attain without fail. So Prabhupada explains this process of the development of consciousness and how that consciousness at the time of death takes us in the subtle body traveling to our next lifetime. The process of changing one's nature at the critical moment of death is here explained. A person who at the end of his life quits his body thinking of Krishna attains the transcendental nature of the Supreme Lord. How can one die in the proper state of mind? One's thoughts during the course of one's life accumulate to influence one's thoughts at the moment of death. So this life creates one's next life. If in one's present life one lives in the mode of goodness and always thinks of Krishna, it is possible for one to remember Krishna at the end of one's life. So that is what we're learning in Krishna consciousness. That is our training. That is our practice. To be able to form the consciousness in such a way and through that accumulation of bhakti, of devotional service. So at the moment of death, that will be our consciousness. The consciousness will be there to remember Krishna. Prabhupada once said, and if for some reason the devotee doesn't remember Krishna, Krishna will force himself into the mind of the devotee. So Krishna will always see that that lifetime of devotional service is rewarded, and Krishna will help the devotee to come back to him. So we need to control the mind. And how do we control the mind in such a way that we can formulate this consciousness towards devotional service and at the end of life remember Krishna? Of course, Arjuna describes it's very difficult to control the mind. In fact, he says it's more difficult to control than the raging wind. So it's not so easy. In fact, most of us could probably give testimony to how difficult it can be to control the mind. The mind will take us all over. So, what do we do? Krishna says, in Bhagavad Gita 6.35, it is undoubtedly very difficult to curb the restless mind. But it is possible by suitable practice and by detachment. So one of those things you say, well, easier said than done, perhaps. But Krishna does give the formula. By suitable practice and detachment, one can learn to control the mind. And that's what we experience in the practice of Krishna consciousness. So that is why we need this sadhana, why we need this spiritual practice. It will help us to control the mind. It will help us not just to control the mind, but it changes the consciousness from fixation on the material and the senses to Krishna. It changes our consciousness to Krishna consciousness. That Krishna becomes the center, that Krishna becomes the object of our activities, the object of our love, of our worship, of everything. So that's the process that's going on. And of course, spiritual practice begins with Shravanam Kirtanam, begins with hearing. Without hearing the Vedic scriptures, without hearing the words of the Guru, Srila Prabhupada, we would simply be lost in our mind. We'd be under the dictations of our mind and our senses, going around lifetime after lifetime in this material world. But when one hears spiritual information, when one hears about the holy name, when one hears about actual spiritual life, the heart changes. The consciousness begins to change. And then as one takes up the processes of chanting, remembering, and the nine processes of devotional service, the consciousness changes more and more. So it's described that there are two results from hearing the Vedic scriptures from a pure devotee. Of course, we need to hear from the right source. We need to hear from the pure devotees such as Srila Prabhupada, from his books. And those two results is one, that one becomes detached from material things and detached from this delusion of duality. And secondly, and probably most important, one becomes attached to Krishna. And of course, they're mutually reinforcing. If one becomes attached to Krishna, naturally one becomes more detached from the material world. And as one gives up those attachments, then it's much easier to become attached to Krishna. So there is quite a great effect by hearing these Vedic literatures, by hearing these transcendental sound vibrations from the right source, from the pure devotee. First of all, it gives transcendental knowledge of a spiritual nature. As we are like reading these verses in these last few days, we're understanding. We're understanding how things are working. What's really going on? What is birth and death? How is it that we go from one body to another? What is the process that is forming our next lifetime? And what do we need to do to change that result from simply, you know, rotating the cycle of samsara in this material world to a path of self-realization, of spiritual realization, of bhakti, beginning our devotional life, relationship with Krishna? So we understand that we're not material. We understand that we're different from the body. We begin to develop our relationship with Krishna. And then and our attraction for the material world lessens as we understand it more and more. And so, of course, also for the process of hearing, it's not just intellectual. We also, our mind becomes attracted to Krishna, to his pastimes, to his devotees, to his devotional service. And that process is also bringing about the purification of the mind. So self-realization, or Krishna consciousness, is ultimately a process of purification. It's a matter of the mind, which is so filled with so many anarthas and samskaras from life after life, to becoming purified, to become attracted to Krishna, to giving up all of that material residue, all of that sense of duality and illusion, and realizing our true nature, the servant of God, the servant of Krishna. So we need to begin to hear Bhagavad Gita and Srimad Bhagavatam. Of course, the Bhagavatam itself in the third chapter describes its own glories, the glories of the Bhagavatam, and how it is able to enlighten the world. And in the purport to 1343, Srila Prabhupada says, in other words, if men in this age of Kali want to see the real light of life, they must take to these two books only, and their aim of life will be fulfilled. Bhagavad Gita is the preliminary study of the Bhagavatam, And Srimad Bhagavatam is the summum bonum of life, Lord Sri Krishna personified. We must therefore accept Srimad Bhagavatam as a direct representation of Lord Krishna. One who can see Srimad Bhagavatam can also see Lord Sri Krishna in person. They are identical. So a wonderful glorification of the Bhagavatam, and how we can understand that these words are none different than Krishna. Of course, we are reading Krishna's direct words here. You know, but even when we're not hearing Krishna's words directly in other parts of the Bhagavatam, it's still all Krishna's words. It's non-different from him. So this process of hearing is very wonderful. It enlightens us in spiritual knowledge, and it helps to clarify things for us and understand that our mind is simply the refuge of the senses, the shelter of the senses, and that generally the mind tends to cause us trouble. Krishna says it can be our best friend or worst enemy. Often we see that it's the enemy. So we want to make it our friend. And we make the mind our friend by engaging it in devotional service. Very simple, straightforward process. We simply engage the senses, we engage the mind, we engage intelligence in Krishna's service, then they become purified. They become spiritualized. And therefore they help us in the path of Krishna consciousness and become the true friend of the living entity. Okay. So, probably read the verse again since we did. And we did finally get it. Because the mind, which is the resting place of the senses, has created the identification with a new body, the threefold material variety of high, middle, and low class appear as if present within the reality of the soul. Thus the self creates external and internal duality, just as a man might give birth to a bad son. Thank you very much. Are there any other comments or questions? Maharaj, did you? Okay. Maharaj?
Just the one. Thank you, Kamahar Bhupa. As usual, very lucid and reasonable, logical presentation. At the beginning, you were mentioning about sleep and necessary for intelligence. Maybe various devotees are familiar, but in Kapila Shiksha, there's a specific description, putting it in perspective. Mm-hmm. It's Samshayam cha viparyayo nishchaya smitir eva cha svapa ityu chate buder lakshanam vrittitakvita. It's giving the five components of intelligence. Begins with doubt, and the next one is misapprehension, in other words, seeing things in a mistaken way. And the next one is seeing things in the right way, nishchaya. And then the next one is remembrance, memory. And then finally, svapa is speech. And these are svapa ityuchate buder lakshanam. These are the symptoms, these are the components. In terms of their different functions, vrittitak, pritak. Another point was the, I just feel so enlivened when I'm thinking something and I have some sort of a realization, or I feel like I'm catching something, and no one else seems to have done it. So, you know, we all want to be very original. So I'm thinking, you know, oh, this is exciting, you know, this is like maybe I can make a contribution or should write something about it. But then usually I find out that other devotees have also come across that. I was listening to Rabindra Swarupabhu's wonderful seminar, three-part seminar on knowledge and faith. And some of the things that I was so fixed on, I won't mention them now, but he was saying exactly the same things. And he said, I'm no Rabindra Swarupabhu, but somehow I just felt so encouraged that others... And the same thing happened in this class when you mentioned that maybe others have also been curious about this, that we always hear about the dualities, heat and cold, happiness and distress, but then there's a whole other kind of duality. You mentioned a third one too, but that I never even thought of, but just the second one, the difference between matter and spirit, how there's a duality. You know, when I was studying Bhakti Vaibhava course in Vrindavan, we only got up to the first canto. We didn't have enough students. But we had to write a paper, an essay. And mine turned out to be too long. It was like 8,000 words. And the whole idea of the essay was exactly on this point. I was trying to... My question was, and maybe you can have some idea of this, there's two completely different understandings of duality, of the, as you mentioned, the dualities, the heat and cold, happiness and distress, just these different phenomena or sense impressions in the material world. And then there's this more metaphysical duality, something called the difference between matter and spirit. Now, in the material world is a world of duality in both ways. Now, what I tried to do in this paper, I don't remember what my philosophical speculation was, but I was trying to figure out, is there a connection between these two senses of duality? Is there an organic relationship between the relativities and that duality, and then that deeper kind of duality? Or are they just, we just keep them separate? And do you have any thoughts on that?
Well, to be honest with you, I just sort of came up with this idea this morning, so I haven't thought as deeply as you have about it. At first glance, they seem like that they're connected. You know, it seems like there's a natural connection that I think one is maybe subsumes the other, or, you know, in other words, the idea of the heat and cold, the sensory dualities may be part of a larger sense of duality of, you know, understanding matter and spirit. And then I think the third thing I was talking about, the understanding of things being different from Krishna, is an artificial duality. Perhaps that's the more all-encompassing, and the others are contained with that. But this is off the top of my head. I haven't really thought about it. I'll have to read your paper, I guess, to understand the topic better. That's a lot of words.
That makes sense. I'm just kind of repeating what you're saying, and if I'm understanding it correctly, that it's that you have, it's subsumed in the sense that you have a higher categorization. We're starting with the second one first, the difference between matter and spirit. So on the one hand, you have this duality. You have matter, you have, say, spirit, and then you have matter.
And now
let's look at matter. Yeah. And then within matter, you have this unlimited myriad set of...
And those are often the ones that are mentioned in the Bhagavad Gita, those dualities, the happiness and distress, the heat and cold, right?
I wish I heard this when I had to write the paper. That really, that kind of almost answers the whole quiz.
Well, thank you very much, Maharaj. And thank you as always for your very deep thoughts on Bhagavatam. Pranagavinda Prabhu. Am I missing? Were there any ladies? I have to make sure. Okay. Go ahead.
I was wondering, Rupa Goswami Pad in Nectar Devotion, he says that Tad Bhavati Madhurje Sruti Dira Apekshate Natra Shastram Na Juktim Tad Lubhot Tad Utpatti Lakshanam. So until the greed and love arise in the heart, one must engage in devotional service by the guidance of intelligence. Intelligence has to be guiding us. Until to that point, that greed has developed, then the love, automatically...
I'm sorry, the point of what is developed? Intelligence guides us until what is developed?
Until greed for love.
Oh, greed for Krishna.
Develops.
Oh, okay, yeah.
Until that point.
Lolium or whatever.
There has to be motivation. Otherwise, it has to be motivated, fear of shastra, duty bound, all kinds of idea comes. Until then. So then, in order to be out of duality, one has to be guided by the intelligence to focus in the devotional service. But then once this love actually in a form of bhava arise, then this actually the mind, what causes the duality before, it becomes a perception. The same mind. becomes a perception, and through that, that actually they see everything in loving relation.
Mind becomes a perception?
Yeah.
What does that mean?
Mind is duality, causing duality before the before the love arises. But it turns into a perception for the devotees who are, like they see everything.
Oh, I see. That's the spiritualized function of the mind.
Correct.
Once one
Correct.
Reaches perfection. Okay.
So if we look at in a higher destiny of Mother Yashoda's seeing the universal form in the mouth of Krishna,
mm-hmm.
in one sense, it is also duality, Sanatana Goswami writes, because she's praying to Narayan, oh, what I'm seeing, this is terrible. I'm thinking I'm the wife of Nanda Maharaj, I'm the mother of this boy, and Krishna is listening.
Mm-hmm.
So what she's praying to Narayan is the same, him. And he didn't like it. Immediately, the internal energy has to intervene and mm-hmm. give more Vatsala Rasa on her, then she forgot about it. So in one sense, that was also duality, but it's such a pure, purified form that it nourished actually both.
Yeah, well, that's actually a very good example, isn't it, of how in the pure spiritual state, how it transcends intelligence, right? In other words, because
yes.
in the platform of intelligence, everything she was saying was correct, right? Understanding all these philosophical considerations, this is really Krishna. But yet, as you said, Krishna wasn't as pleased with that as when she was just thinking, I am Krishna's mother and the Vatsalya Rasa. Yeah. It's an interesting topic. We don't have time to get into it, but in one sense, we transcend the mind, we transcend the intelligence, the senses, and there's another sense where they're spiritualized, and you give some indication of the spiritual utilization of the mind, intelligence, things in its purest forms. So that would be another interesting essay. Think about that one. Okay, anything else? Other thoughts, questions, comments? Okay, thank you very much. All glories to Srila Prabhupada.